Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. We're here to share a lot of information today about self-empowerment, social issues. We'll have a talk-back segment. We're going to hear from Colonel Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff, and he's going to have some very interesting insights to talk about the State Department at that time and what questions I have of why didn't Powell, when he found out that he had been lied to, why didn't he speak out? Well, we're going to talk about the U.S. State Department, its changing role and mission, and the loss of America's influence in the world. And if you are listening right now over your app, well, good for you. You're getting a clearer signal, and for anyone who has a cell phone, if you go to the area of your cell phone called the store where you get different apps, you'll see prn.fm. That way you can get your app and listen anywhere you go that you can pick up a signal on your cell phone, you can hear us. For everyone else, you can hear us over your radio or over the internet, but also over any portable listening device or telephone. Let me give you that number, 424-203-8046. Again, anywhere, cab drivers use it, truck drivers use it. I get a lot of feedback from people, so now they can hear the show live Monday to Friday, noon to 1, 424-203-8046. But let's say you're working, you can't listen, you go home at night. You can go to the archives and download up to 5 programs on one call. That number, write it down, please, 701-719-9976. I want to begin with the latest on health and healing, as I do every day, keeping in mind that this information comes from peer-reviewed journals and mainstream science. For example, from the University of Colorado and also Haifa University in Israel, and a Paris university, a study shows women experience less pain when holding a loved one's hand. A team of researchers from these different institutions has found that women sense less pain when they're holding a hand of a person that they love. And this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And the group describes the experiments they conducted in which women were exposed to some degree of pain and were then asked to report how painful it felt under different conditions. Well, in modern times, it's become common in some countries for husbands or other loved ones to be invited to the delivery room to offer comfort as a woman experiences one of the worst pains of life, and that's the pain of a childbirth. But does such hand-holding actually offer any benefits to the woman in pain? And they tested this with 20 different couples willing to undergo this who were pregnant, and the experiments consisted of that, and it found out there was a remarkable improvement. But I can tell you this, that from my own experience, that holding someone's hand who is in pain, emotional pain or physical pain, people who are at the end of life, who might be in hospice care, that human contact, looking people gently in the eyes with a smile, and that tactile touch makes all the difference in the world. And for those of us who spend our lives nursing people, bonding with people, trying to help people, you have to get from behind the desk. You have to sit across some people. You have to make them feel non-vulnerable to authority. And even when loved ones are, you know, when a child hurts themselves and the mother kisses the boo-boo and suddenly they stop crying and it's okay. Well, what was that about? It was about the total trust that whatever came into that child's life, the mother or father, was there to help them. Now imagine the power of being in any form of friendship or relationship where that other person has such trust in you that you'll always have their back. You'll always be there for them. That's important, especially at a time when we have so many people who feel removed and lonely, and where they don't have people to talk with, let alone someone to hug or someone to walk with or someone to share a moment with. Think of all the wonderful times in your life where you've been at an experience, a play, a concert, but you're there alone. In New York City, there was, it's closed down unfortunately, the Lincoln Plaza, and for decades I have enjoyed walking down from my apartment to the Lincoln Plaza. And more often than not, I see people in there alone, mainly older people, and they'll watch the movie and they'll walk out. And they don't have anyone to talk with at that moment, because those are more often than not very interesting films. But when you're seeing someone with someone, almost always, because there's a slow pace of getting out, and people say, "What'd you think?" And they start talking. And just sharing that camaraderie, sharing that interest in someone else's experience, and does it harmonize with your own? All over Manhattan, you'll see people eating alone. That's fine. You don't have to be lonely because you're eating alone. But think of the joy when you're sharing a meal with someone. I just think that we are a society that has allowed social media and social isolation and this artificial ageism, this bias that a person's a certain age and therefore no longer desirable or interesting or worthy of company. And a lot of people, even who were very social at one time in their life today, feel that they've been removed and therefore they must not deserve to be in this environment, whether younger people or other people. So we have an epidemic of loneliness in America. And with that, frequently becomes depressed. And then with that, you start feeling all the pains. So something as simple as being able to be with people and walk, hold hands, get hugs, it makes a difference. And that's what this study was showing, that you're actually sharing an energy. And that energy of people who love each other can reduce pain. I've mentioned many times the power of an oil. It is the most powerful of all oils. That's black seed oil. And black seed oil, according to University College London, published in Psychotherapeutic Research, puts deadly asthma medications to shame. That's correct. The black cumin seed oil, known as Nigella, N-I-G-E-L-L-A, Sativa, S-A-T-I-V-A. It's once again a superstar, this time proving that food can be a powerful asthma medication alternative. In a new study, it was revealed that this powerful little black seed, once referred to as the remedy for everything but death, may provide a powerful alternative to pharmaceutical medicine in the treatment of asthma. Now, this is extremely promising for the millions of chronic asthma sufferers who are still taking medications like long-acting beta agonists, and which the FDA warned back in 2006 actually increased the risk of dying from asthma. Well, in the new study entitled Nigella Sativa Supplementation Improves Asthma Control and Biomarkers, a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, and it work much better than the placebo, had major benefit. And this was for 4 weeks. So if you have asthma, or if you have bronchial infections or inflammation, if you have any form of lung congestion, congestion in your chest, maybe from a cold or flu, where you have a rebound infection, you didn't purge the infection or strengthen your immune system before you went back to work or got active again, or didn't get enough sleep. So, black cumin seed oil, 1 teaspoon, 3 times a day, in a protein shake. Now, I drink it just straight out of the bottle, but I can drink a lot of things like lemon juice and apple cider vinegar, and it doesn't bother me. But I suggest for other people, put that into a protein shake. At the same time, put a teaspoon of Manuka honey, also olive leaf extract, 1,000 milligrams, echinacea, 100 milligrams, Paudarco, P-A-U-R-D-C-O, Darco, 100 milligrams, vitamin C, 2,000 milligrams, quercetin, 2,000 milligrams, probiotics, about 10 to 15 billion. You can get them in a bottle, and it tells you how much there are. And also 20 drops of wild oregano oil. Now, all that goes into your protein shake. And then you sip that over an hour, about 16 ounces. And you do that three times a day. Watch what happens to your lungs, to inflammation, to aching joints, to aching muscles, to headaches, to throat congestion, phlegm buildup. It makes an enormous difference. So those are the things that we should spend some time putting into our body. And this was a randomized placebo-controlled study. Now, the other oil that is a superstar oil is cannabis, C-A-N-N-A-B-I-S. Here's a study from Vanderbilt University, and it says that about one-third of the patients treated for epilepsy continue to have seizures. Well, cannabinoid, one of the many active compounds in the cannabis plant, has gained attention because it helps with epilepsy. Purified CBD is being tested, and it's the oil, and it's not the marijuana plant, and they're showing that it had a 50% reduction in seizures. Wow. And then 10% became seizure-free. And then 22% were able to reduce the doses of other anti-seizure medications. So it's terrific. And the scientific literature supports it. A lot of people don't understand how to deal with depression and anxiety. And they take the meds. Maybe for a week or two or three or four, you might feel better because the very low end of depression is capped, but so is the high end of any sense of anxiety. So you're kind of in this middle zone, some people. But then it wears off, and then you start getting all the negative effects of the medication itself, including the fact it's very difficult to wean off most of these. And then you can look at the side effects from suicide ideation to hyper-anxiety. So the irony of it is that we're giving antidepressant medications that have depression as a side effect and antipsychotic medications that have psychosis as a side effect. We're giving people who we fear might commit suicide a drug that will cause suicide. It just shows you the lack of integrity and decency in the entire field, which I believe what we're at a very close to being at a new age of reason, because what we've done for the last 100 years lacks all reason. And I believe we're at a point of a new renaissance, that glorious time of enlightenment. And generally, when you have an age of reason, you start looking at life differently. You look at some ideals that you may have lived at or want to, but have kept from being there because of circumstances or conditioning or relationships. Something has prevented you from living at that level of idealism. And I'm not talking about an artificial idealism. I'm talking about something where you're really living at a level of harmony. I wished every young person today could read Immanuel Kant's argument in the essay Perpetual Peace. He wrote it back in 1795. And he talked about that the human race should work for a cosmopolitan constitution. And by the way, that is exactly what the UN was ideally supposed to be. And also during the Age of Reason, and enlightenment, sometimes it's called both, the Age of Enlightenment. It was a little earlier, but you had René Descartes, and his Discourse on the Method, written in 1637. And then you had John Locke and Isaac Newton and David Hume and Voltaire and Immanuel Kant. And that caused millions of people to benefit from a deeper way of looking, that you got rid of superstition. You got rid of the absolute control of the church or different religions being the only doctrine by which you could make a decision and value life. And it ended around the French Revolution in 1789, but it might have been also the Reign of Terror in 1793. But remember, our Constitution, our values for the founding fathers, as shown by Thomas Paine in The Age of Reason in 1794, was based upon all these other minds before them. And then from one of the last great minds, Bertrand Russell and Albert Schweitzer, we went into a void. We became a pop culture. But we no longer had an emphasis upon the minds. We had the minds, they just weren't being given the attention that they deserve. So we've gone through a period where we have not used reason. So I believe we're at a point where there's so many really good minds, men and women, who can share insights that will allow us to go, oh, I didn't think of that. That's interesting. Wow, that's just common sense. That's just reasonable age of reason. And I believe we're there. We're really close to it. So I'm optimistic. Anyhow, this study from the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Canada showed that over the years, depression changes the brain. And the reason I believe that we're having chronic depression is because of the belief system that you are insignificant, you are, in effect, helpless, that now everything in our life is controlled by the federal government. And this become a police state and totalitarian and fascistic in its methods and operations. Every phone call is monitored. I mean, could you imagine living in a society that we call democracy that's not, it's a republic and representative republic, but our representatives are all bought and are there purely for themselves, where the media is complicit and we're expected to believe anything anyone says without knowing what is their ulterior motive. Why are they saying what they're saying? What's behind it? And we don't want to look behind it. We're afraid of the truth that our illusions of democracy and freedom will be somehow usurped. So we simply stop. And we either accept what someone says in its full value or we reject it. We don't parse what someone says and say, okay, let me open this door and find the truth in what you say. Is there something or nothing, part or whole, that I can support or believe in? We just reject it out of hand, or we accept it blindly. Both are very dangerous. So in any case, when you live with depression, and you shouldn't, because there are so many easy ways of dealing with it, it's going to change the actual brain in your skull. And I do not accept that depression is an illness. I believe it is a behavior, and therefore within our control. If you say it's a disease, it's a noun. If you say it's a verb, it's something that can change. If I look in a mirror and say, oh, I have cancer, suddenly I'm taken out of the equation of being able to deal with it because I have to let the experts deal with it because it's a noun, it's a disease. Why me? But what if I said I'm cancering, therefore, oh, it's a process. Well, that's something I can get involved with. I can make changes. I can do things. I can change my diet, my attitude, my place of work. I can do a lot to do something. So I believe we're at a time now where enough people have critical mass adjustment that we can literally change paradigms. But we can't correct paradigms. We can't rehabilitate paradigms. We have to create new ones. And that is what I'm looking forward to. Also, in the University of Pennsylvania, caloric restriction, once again, is not only good for you, but aids intestinal regeneration. An article published in Stem Cell Reports reveals a benefit of calorie restriction in the regeneration of the intestinal tissue after injury. And so they found that if you have a caloric reduction by 40% from a normal intake, it reserves the intestinal stem cells and expanded by a factor of 500%. And when these cells are removed, intestinal regeneration capability was lowered. Quote, these reserve stem cells are rare cells. In a normal animal, they may make up less than half a percentage of the intestinal epithelium, and in calorie-restricted animals, maybe slightly more. Normally, in the absence of injury, the tissue can tolerate the loss due to the presence of the active stem cells. But when you injure yourself, the regeneration is compromised, and the enhanced regeneration after caloric restriction was compromised in the absence of the reserve stem cells. So in lay language, I was just reading from the actual study, if you want to heal faster, especially if you have colitis, Crohn's disease, spastic colitis, ileitis, diverticulitis, ulcers, all of that is similar to your lips and your mouth. That is a different type of cell than the rest of the skin on your body. And that's the mucous membrane. So if you want that to heal faster, then all you have to do is make sure that you're properly restricting calories during that period of time. And I told you how to do that by having more juices and smoothies. Liquefy a lot of your vegetables and only have a high degree of living foods. And finally, there's an article from the University of New Mexico published in Military Medicine and Oxford University Press that shows that military personnel are making extensive use of outside mental health services and suggesting that the military health and mental health services do not meet the needs of active duty service members. Well, that's a gross understatement. I think that for many of the GIs today, and I can't state this for previous wars, but boy, have they, we have just made a cataclysmic mistake. We send young men and women into war, all psyched out, indoctrinated. And then when they do the best they can, whatever that is, or they de-evolve down emotionally because of what they've seen, the trauma, and they carry that trauma with them. And you can't be in a war, an active engagement, without being adversely affected. But when you get out, there's no place to go, as there is a boot camp to train you not to think before you act on orders. But what happens when you get out? No one turns that program around. No one says, okay, I'm going home. I'm going to be with my family and friends. I don't want to take that war mindset, that conflict mindset, that trigger reaction mindset back into that environment. It's not healthy. We don't care. So this is showing that a lot of these individuals are getting out of that. And that reminds me of when I was helping some vets, which I still do, not just do a documentary, but I actually send money over there to help feed them and every day where they can get a free meal. I ask, what is it you want? Hundreds I asked this question to when I was filming. And they say, we just want some help. And these meds are killing us. All of them acknowledge that. The only answer the medical, military industrial complex has is give them psychiatric meds. And then they're killing 23 of them their own each day. They're killing themselves. Thousands upon thousands have killed themselves. More have killed themselves after their conflict, when they're home, on the meds, than died in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq combined. Not a word about this. Like it doesn't count. Well, sure does. You're talking with over a million military personnel. It makes a big difference. So anyhow, they don't like how they feel on the meds. They don't like how it makes them feel angry. And then they're all being labeled as post-traumatic stress, and that then gets them into a medical deadly cycle. So here's the idea. In the next 12 months, I intend to open up a free facility with humanistic help from clinical psychologists using a humanistic model to help them understand how to release that energy and change their perceptions from post-traumatic, using animals that they bond with, using a clean, healthy diet, using a rebalancing of brain chemistries, body chemistries, with a proper supplementation in a humanistic, a bucolic environment. I'm going to start with maybe 15, and at a certain point bring their families in and relatives, friends, and let them also see the evolution of someone who is damaged, will not fit into society, is likely going to end up either in jail, a mental institution, or on the street homeless, and bring them back to a sense of calm, normal, and balance. I'm going to film all this, so at least we can see, does it work? I know it works individually because I've done it for a lot, but on a group, in one environment, and then encourage people around the United States to do this in their own communities. And by the way, talking about health, this is from Natural Health 365. Quote, antipsychotic drugs used for dementia patients increase the risk of death by 60%. Whoa. Now, we know that antipsychotic drugs are often prescribed to persons with serious mental health issues, and it doesn't help them. However, researchers in University of Eastern Finland is showing that antipsychotic drugs raise the risk of death by 60%. In fact, using two or more antipsychotic drugs doubles the risk of premature death. So you know how that's going to go. And when people are on these antipsychotics, they stay on them forever until they die. And this is just showing you how quickly they die. I do not recommend these at all. Screws up your blood pressure, and it's not good. Also, from one other segment, I got this in and I wanted to read this to you. I verified it's accurate. And this is from the Alliance for Natural Health. Quote, a 64-year-old woman had chest pains and was taken by ambulance to a non-profit hospital. She was there and got 3 hours with a test, and she was told she had indigestion, sent home. Okay. Her bill was $21,000. This is a nonprofit hospital, $21,000, to be told she has indigestion. The tests themselves cost under $500. Another patient was told that he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He went to MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston and was examined, and they set up what would be a treatment plan, and he went home. He was charged just for that little tiny thing, $83,900. $83,000 to be told, here's what you should do for your non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Another patient was charged $1.50 for a single generic Tylenol tablet. By the way, that's more than the entire bottle. And a person was throwing up and was taken to an ambulance room by friends, and just to check what happened and nothing happened. In other words, person stopped, their throwing up was okay, but just to be there for that short period of time and have someone look at them, $8,000. One hospital in New Jersey will charge for a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease treatment $100,000. But 30 miles away, a different hospital for the same identical treatment, $7,000. Sound kind of Kafka-like to you? This is why the Clintons, the Obamas, the Bushes, Trump, all of them, and all the people around them, and their inner circles, and everyone in the Washington Consensus, and the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Trilateral Commission, the real power players behind everyone, they don't want universal health care. They want you to, they're connected to people who need to profit off everything. And I say, we should protest this. We should have universal health care so no one is charged ever again $22,000, be told that you're okay. I mean, how do people get away with it? Because it's perfectly legal, because the system allows it to do so. We're going to take a break and come right back. That's the latest. We're half hour into our program, 30 minutes on health and healing. Back and again with our guests. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. Thank you very much for joining us. We're going now to my guest, and this is a continuation of our Conversations with the Remarkable Mind series. The topic is the U.S. State Department, its changing role and mission, and the loss of America's influence and frequently respect around the world. My guest is in Virginia. He is Colonel Lawrence Workison, and he is a retired U.S. Army colonel and the former chief of staff to General Colin Powell while he was Secretary of State. He's currently a distinguished adjunct professor of government and public policy at the College of William & Mary in Virginia. And he started as an assistant to General Powell in 1989 and remained with him through his term in the Bush administration. And he has been an outspoken critic of the Iraq War and the Bush and Cheney White House, including his own preparation for what became Colin Powell's infamous 2003 presentation regarding Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction to the UN. And he's had a very distinguished career, having been trained in the Army, the Marines, and Navy, and he's a frequent commentator on radio television programs, including The Ed Show and also The Real News, PBS, and others. He is the author also of some important articles, but he's also featured in several important documentaries, including Why We Fight, separately The Israeli Lobby, and also No End in Sight. And in 2009, he received the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you.
I'd like, if you would please, to discuss the fundamental changes that have taken place in the domestic and international role and mission in the State Department during the course of the past several administrations, right up to the present. But before we do that, I just have this issue, if you would address it also. Unlike yourself being publicly outspoken about the challenges of having to deal post ex facto with the misinformation that the Cheney vice president and Scooter Libby and others gave about the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction, I have not personally heard former Secretary of State and General Powell speak out about this, though that's possibly he has, and I just haven't personally heard it. But since you were with him then and after, and if I'm assured stayed in some communication, what is his feelings, his honest feelings about what happened, and does he hold those who misled him responsible?
Well, I take your second question first. I never presume to speak for Colin Powell. He can speak for himself. He has spoken for himself. I will say that I have not been aware of, nor am I currently aware of, any statement by the general, the former secretary, that would indicate to me that he feels any differently than he did at the time he actually presented the information he did. And I would describe that feeling as one of, yeah, the intelligence was wrong, but everybody in the United States government, including most of the Congress, including the administration, and everyone in several counterpart intelligence communities around the world, from France to Israel, agreed at the time that the intelligence was enough to act on. Whether or not it was enough to essentially constitute a preemptive war is another matter, and I don't, as I said, I'm not going to speak for him on that. As to your question about the State Department, that's, in my view, right now, a very serious issue, and it has two components to it. One is the long history of essentially Republican, but Democrats have added to it, too, through various administrations, such as Carter's and even President Obama's. That institutional creep from away from the State Department to the White House was caused by what was created in 1947 that essentially designed a National Security Council that anyone looking at closely now must conclude has become the instrument of U.S. foreign and security policy, not the State Department. The State Department is a place that issues visas, has a consular affairs section, has an economic section, a political section, and so forth, mans embassies and consulates around the world, and does very little else. If the State Department has a very powerful, charismatic secretary, then that person, as a statutory member of the President's National Security Council, does have some influence, but increasingly less and less, because when you bring $40, $50, $60 billion to the fight, and your counterpart, the Pentagon, brings $600 billion to the fight, you are almost always defeated. So that's the institutional aspect of the decrease in State Department influence over time. Mostly Republicans, but Democrats have contributed. Now the situation is such that we have not only that institutional diminution of power, we have a president who thinks he is the only diplomat that counts. And he is not willing, nor I think able, intellectually or otherwise, to grasp the fact that he is, one, a lousy diplomat, two, inexperienced and unintelligent as far as diplomacy is concerned, and three, has mostly military people around him to advise him when he is in a moment of inexperience and void. And those people are going to give him the kind of advice that I know all too well, the kind of advice that comes from military professionals, the kind of advice that skews U.S. security policy towards use of the military instrument and towards further diminution and even elimination of the diplomatic instrument. And that's where we are today. We are a warfare state. We live, breathe, eat, sleep, drink, and otherwise live to make war.
I want you to go a little further, if you would, please, on that. When I was watching the different networks of how they're covering the lead up to any conflict, whether it was Iraq, but later in Libya and in Syria, without exception, both sides, even NPR, they all were for the military, and they bent over backwards to talk about how they're for the military, as if somehow to challenge the excesses or even the saneness of some of these policies is anti-patriotic. Tell us about what it means to be in that position where you're going to inflict the full power and might of the United States military and intelligence services, because one doesn't work without the other, and the CIA, without looking at the likely outcome and consequences, included intended and unintended consequences, and then taking no responsibility whatsoever for what we do anywhere in the world where there is a blowback or there is a consequence.
Well, you've just summed it up pretty well. All I need to do is say footnote to your answer. What we are doing, in addition to what you just said in a rather brilliant summary of what is our foreign and security policy, what we've been doing is killing hundreds of thousands of people around the world with the military instrument, starting with Vietnam, where we probably kill somewhere around 2.5 million Vietnamese. And we've been doing that without any regard for the fact we're doing that, to include, for example, a day not even helping in a significant way the Vietnamese to clean up the mines we left or to deal with the massive deforestation we did with Agent Orange and other things like that, all the way up to the present where we have tortured people, murdered people who were being held in detention in the CIA's RDI program, retention, detention, interrogation program. 119 people we rendered, and 38 or so of those actually died by a coroner's report by homicide. That's murder. And we have paid no reparations, made no apologies, not even admitted to anyone in the world that we did it. So, I mean, you look across the scope of Vietnam to that infamous torture program, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, the war with Somalia, the war in Pakistan. I mean, we're at war or killing people across nine international borders today. As I said, we live and exist to make war. The influences that cause this are everything from Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, you name the company that makes billions of dollars every year off of these wars, to a Congress, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the war-making complex, to an executive, now an executive, who thinks he ought to have his sole finger on the nuclear button and consult no one before he pushes it. And you have a summary of what we have become.
What value do you see the process of lobbying doing with these major corporations, Raytheon you just mentioned, but there are a lot more. I looked up who were the number top 20 contributors to politicians in Washington in the last election cycle, and most Americans would not be aware of how many of these are major corporations. They think that, well, these are just good corporations. For example, I'll tell you the specifics. The number one lobbyist in the United States last year was U.S. Chamber of Commerce, $103 million. The National Association of Realtors, $64 million. Blue Cross Blue Shield, $25 million. The American Hospital Association, Big Pharma, American Medical Association. Then you get to yours, Boeing, the AT&T Business Roundtable, Alphabet, Comcast, Southern Cal, Dow Chemical, FedEx, the Northrop Grumman, ExxonMobil, Amazon, the General Dynamics, Verizon, Amgen, Koch Brothers, Pfizer, American Banking Association, Prudential, Biotechnology Innovations, United Technologies, and the American Chemical Society, and Royal Dutch Shell. Those are the top lobbyists. They're giving a lot of money, over $1 billion, to legislators. Could you take us now from that to what the consequences are?
Well, I think you left one out there. I just did the same thing you did recently with my students. There are different sources and different ways you can look at this. I actually looked at it individual by individual in the Senate and in the House, how much they got, say, in fiscal 16, how much they've gotten so far in fiscal 17, and I looked all at everything from individual donations, which, of course, are restricted. What is it now? 5,000, I think. And I looked at the bigger donations that are made to nefarious things like political action committees, some of which are under Federal Election Commission, some of which are not. So when you put all this together, you also have a huge one in there called the National Rifle Association, which, of course,
yes,
is under real scrutiny right now. But you're right. Big oil, big food, big pharmacy, big real estate and insurance, big war, and big guns run this country. It's that simple. It's their money that goes to congressmen that determines laws, and increasingly, at least 10 to 15% of those laws are now made in secret. Yes, complete secret. We don't even know. Amy Benjamin has a really fine article out right now about this. She's a terrific scholar. She's gone into it in detail. She's expanded what Bill Arkin and Dana Priest did, for example, in the Washington Post series and then in their book about secrecy. And she demonstrates conclusively and dramatically how many of our laws are now made by the Congress in secret. We don't even know what they say. So if we come up against one of those laws and we're prosecuted for it, we have no idea why we're being charged, why we're being prosecuted, and in some cases, we might even not know why we're being incarcerated. This is America today. These big outfits with all of their money run this country. Let me give you a graphic example. I've been on the Hill in the Senate and the House for the past 2 months demonstrating to senators and representatives that the U.S. support for the Saudi Arabia-UAE waged war in Yemen is illegal. Title 50, U.S. Code, Chapter 33, Sections 1541 to 48, which is the War Powers Resolution codified into law, makes our participation in that conflict illegal. Congressmen don't even want to hear about it. When we pointed out to them that a War Powers Resolution piece of legislation, which we were working on, House Legislation 81, was privileged and had to go before the House without any committee stopping it, without any congressman having the ability to derail it. It had to go to the full Congress for debate. What happens? Committee chairmen who are heavily, heavily into Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and others for political donations, like Marv Thornberry in the House, who heads the House Armed Services Committee, calls over to Ed Royce at the House Foreign Relations Committee, and, of course, gets it stopped. Gets with a parliamentarian, does some tricks, and gets it stopped. So after 2 months, we're still trying to get this legislation through the House and through the Senate. We're making a little more progress now. But this is a war in Yemen, one of the most brutal humanitarian disasters in post-World War II history. And we're complicit in it. And let me tell you something. The people in the region who increasingly see the United States as the greatest threat to world security and certainly to their security, do not look at this war in Yemen as a Saudi war. They look at it as the Saudis being the proxy of the United States. So now you know why we have 3.5 to 4 billion people in the world, yes, I said billion, who in poll after poll identify the number one security threat to the world, often the number one terrorist threat to the world, as being the United States of America.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Could you continue a thread on that thought with this? The United States supplies a great percentage of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait arms in our trading arrangements, and the largest single arms trade deal in history, I believe, was closed on Christmas Eve, or near. It was in the Christmas season by Hillary Clinton's State Department. They actually celebrated it at the time, and Trump has picked up on that. Obama did a lot also, but we do not, as a people, nor the media, hold Saudi Arabia responsible for what it does with its money and with our arms. And we have absolute proof that it has supported other terrorist organizations, and it has led the whole campaign in the poorest country in the Middle East, which is Yemen. And could you tell us about the largest cholera epidemic in the world, which is in Yemen, and the bombing, intentional bombing of hospitals and water treatment plants that go against acts of the that are illegal internationally? And constitute war crimes that our media doesn't expose. You have yet to have the major media there on the ground, just like you don't have the media in the Palestinian camps in Gaza or West Bank. We choose to stay completely void of exposing any of this to the American consciousness. Could you explain that to us, please?
I think if we explained it, if the corporately owned media were honest and truthful, you'd get at least a sizable and powerful minority of Americans, if not a small majority, that would be so appalled by it that they'd begin to make constituent visits and phone calls and send emails and so forth, and we might be able to get the United States out of this brutal war. So that's the reason the the corporately owned media and other agencies of influence in this country, who, let's face it, are owned by these entities we just talked about, big oil, big food, big pharmacy, big real estate and insurance, big war, NRA. That's the reason they don't try to alert the American people to the criminality that's going on over there. You didn't even mention the Saudis bombed the portside cranes that would offload food for these starving people. We then shipped cranes to replace those cranes and had to stand offshore with those cranes and couldn't offload them so they could be reconstructed because the Saudis threatened to bomb them again and bomb the ships that were delivering them. So this is terrible what's going on over there, and it's just the surface. I mean, what's going on in Afghanistan, what's going on in Pakistan, Somalia, Niger, Syria, writ large in Syria, which is about to bite us big time because we've got NATO allies fighting and just such a mess. It's incredible. It's hard for me to imagine how we got ourselves so deeply mired in Syria. But to your point about the Saudis, one of the reasons we got ourselves so deeply mired in Syria is the Saudis. When they saw that Bashar al-Assad might have some problems, 200,000 Syrian farmers with no water, footnote that, because that's an aspect of climate change that this administration doesn't even recognize as a happening. 200,000 Syrian farmers without water for 2 years in a row started basically a nonviolent protest. The Saudis got wind of it. The Saudis saw an opportunity to overthrow Assad, sent in foreign fighters with guns and money and everything, backed ISIS, backed Al-Qaeda, backed anybody that would fight against Assad. We saw that happening and said, oh, the Saudis are friends. We better help them. So Syria is just a rotten mess and, of course, came about ultimately because of our having disturbed the balance of power in the region by overthrowing Saddam Hussein in 2003. So, you know, all of these problems in the world that we contend through our corporate media and the myth of America's messianic mission in the world is out there for us to fix, we created in the first place and made the need to fix it. So the last 20 years have been a disaster for American foreign and security policy, but a disaster that you can track very clearly, very dramatically back to moneyed interest, back to power. Follow the money, the old dude said. That's exactly what you need to do. War is very profitable. War will occur more and more. We have been at war for 17 straight years, and I see no end in sight.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and bring this to our audience attention. How can we help you and your group support stopping the war in Yemen? What would you like us to do?
Cards, letters, phone calls, even more powerful are constituent visits. We're trying to arrange visits right now from every state in the Union, from groups like the Quakers, Win Without War, you name it, anybody who's interested in and has some meaningful organization and ability to provide people to go to their congressman's office. There's nothing more powerful than an Illinois citizen going to an Illinois representative's office, or Texas, or California, or North Carolina, or whatever. And in lieu of that, emails, phone calls are better than emails. Talk to your senator, talk to your representatives, plural, and tell them, get out. This is illegal. We shouldn't be doing this. This is brutal. Get out.
We're going to do exactly that, and I appreciate you coming on and letting us know how we can help your cause. Thank you very much, Colonel Wilkerson.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Wilkerson. Just a couple thoughts as we round out our program today. There are people in this audience who are doing good work and always have been, and I want to commend you for that. We have a whole group of listeners, doctors, professors, lawyers, school teachers, who are now signing up to be citizen journalists. They're working on important stories. We're not rushing it. And once their initial scholarship and research is done, then we're going to present that information to you on the air. So you'll be introduced to a whole lot of new people. If you want to be a citizen journalist and help the cause of social change, the very things that Colonel Wilkerson was talking about, just go to prnstudio prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com. And one of the people who did something, I just ran into him this past Saturday at the farmer's market. And his father came up to me, and his father says, "Gary, you remember me, Tony Benevenuto. I used to listen to WBAN, listen to you in the 1980s. That's where I became an activist." Well, his son, Michael Benevenuto, was at Ramapo High School in the class of 1992, and he was listening to the program also, and he decided to do something, and so he became become an activist, and it was important for him to really promote recycling for his high school with help of his parents. And this was before recycling really caught on. And it motivated to where he got the whole high school and the whole county and then a lot of the state recycling. So you see one person, one young idealist. Michael was an idealist. He's an attorney today. And he was down there with his father. I met him. And that was a long time ago. But he has stayed an activist to this day. So for all of you who want to make a better world, thank you for putting your time and energy out there. And by the way, tonight at 7 p.m., you talk about someone who can shake and stir a conversation. Wim Binney is my guest tonight, and we're going to talk about the truth of the National Security Agency and whistleblowers and discussing the agenda and corruption, the unconstitutional activities. Just him. He is my only guest tonight for 1 hour live. And tomorrow I'm going to have Professor Michael Mann, British-born sociologist and UCLA professor and Cambridge University professor, on talking about our Great Mind series. And I have a guest every day this week, always good people. And also tonight, following Progressive Commentary Hour at 8 o'clock, I'm going to do a conversation by internet or telephone conference call for those individuals who are at a point in their life where they're considering living off the grid, not rural rough, but living outside of the cities in intentional communities. I'm going to have a whole discussion on that. If you're interested, email prnstudio@gmail.com and say you want someone to call you about the intentional community, and someone will call you today and give you the information on it. That's it for today. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.